This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, as we approach the fifth anniversary of the war in Iraq, we'll look at how all kinds of wars have left their mark on culture. For instance, how movies let us replay the domestic struggle over Vietnam long after the fall of Saigon.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
And we'll talk to writers who've lived through wars, like Emmanuel Dungala, who was caught in the brutal conflict in the Congo.
During this bombing, while people were praying or crying or whatever, what I was doing is reading.
And we'll hear from my interview with the late Susan Sontag, who lived in Sarajevo in the 90s during the war that attended the breakup of Yugoslavia.
I said, why do you want me to direct a play? Oh, well, because we have lots of actors who have nothing to do. I said, actors? You don't have theaters. You just have bombed places.
That is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI's Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. 5 years ago, as the invasion of Iraq was becoming an inevitability, Susan Sontag joined me in Studio 360. I wanted to talk with her about depictions of war and her own experiences of wartime as well. Sontag, who died in 2004, was an essayist, a novelist, a filmmaker, a director, altogether a central figure in our intellectual life for the last several decades. Years ago, she had very influentially argued that looking at photographs from war zones and atrocities might desensitize us, make us more complacent about horrible things being done to other people. But Susan Sontag revisited that idea in her book Regarding the Pain of Others and found that she'd sort of changed her mind.
Well, my experience in Sarajevo between 1993 and the end of 1995, where I lived most of the time in that period while the city was under siege in Sarajevo, was really a very special experience in that I wasn't there all the time for that 3 years. I was coming back and forth. I actually was there 14 times, never less than 2 weeks, never more than 2 months, because I did like to get out and take a bath. There was no water or electricity or any kind of communication with the outside world except the UN planes. And I had that unique experience of being in a very tight, confined war zone, experiencing what everybody was experiencing. We were all on the same level, whether we were foreign people or residents, because it was the city was surrounded and under siege. And then being able to go out and see how it was reported. And I discovered that oddly enough, the experience for most people of seeing the war, say, on television, because that would be the main access to the war through the media, even more than the print images, it didn't fully convince people of the reality of the war. I mean, it was almost as if what they saw on television every night about the siege and all the people being killed in Sarajevo was some kind of photo op. I actually had people ask me when I would come back to New York, well, I remember one very intelligent person saying to me, do you personally feel you're in danger when you're in Sarajevo? And I couldn't believe I was being asked such a question. Yeah, exactly. And I said, I found myself saying, I said, do you watch television? And he said, yes. I said, do you see what's going on there every night in the news? He said, yes. I said, well, that's what it's like. And he said, oh, my God. It's actually somewhere, it was as if for him, well, that was something.
Well,
not so much a film, but the way something horrible, an accident might happen on one street corner here in New York City, and everyone would rush and it would be on the evening news. But in the meantime, the rest of the city life was proceeding as normal. I think it is hard to take in the reality through images. And I think every journalist and aid worker and foreigner who was in Sarajevo felt when they would leave, because of the peculiar protracted nature of the siege and how totally weird that was, that basically if you weren't there, you didn't understand. Maybe that's a feeling that everybody has who's in a war, that if you hadn't been there, if you hadn't been in a war, in any war, you couldn't really understand what it was like.
Was this book aborning while you were there? Or did you suddenly feel, no, my view of what images can do has changed?
It was the second. I didn't for a minute think about writing when I was there. I wasn't there to write. I wasn't there to write a book at all. I was there to pitch in and work in various projects in the city, and it was a rather quixotic thing to do, but I wasn't there as a writer. No, it came because I began to think about what these images mean, and I began to think about a lot of the reigning cliches about images of war. I'll tell you one, which, of course, we're all familiar with, which is that we're very blasé now. We see so many images of atrocity, so many images of horror, that we actually don't react to them anymore.
A thought you had yourself had once published
exactly.
Grandly.
I'm afraid I'm at the origin of that very widespread view. At least I thought it was a fairly original observation when I made it as central to that book of essays that I wrote and that I published about 25 years ago called On Photography. Well, I don't think it's true. And I guess I like to argue with myself and, well, not because I just like to argue with myself, because I like to think that I have a better view, that my experience teaches me something. If we don't learn from our experience, then well, what else can we learn from? And I think my view, which I think has been influential, is too simple. I don't think we just become inured or desensitized. I think it's a much more complicated process. And I think if people do feel turned off or indifferent to images of horror and war and suffering that they see and that they feel indignant about, I think it comes not because they're blasé, but because they feel impotent or powerless. And I think that's a perfectly understandable reaction.
So in a sense, your change of heart about the power of images to portray war and atrocity, it represents kind of a disillusioning or a reillusioning.
Well, that's a very clever way of putting it. A disillusioning, yes. The disillusionment. That's right. That's absolutely right.
Susan Sontag talking with me in 2003 on the eve of the Iraq War. I asked Sontag about the depictions of war in writing and art through the centuries. One of the things we talked about was Homer's Iliad.
Well, you know, it's so interesting how in this great epic poem of almost 3,000 years ago, Homer is portraying the horror and the pity of war, because it's full of pity for the sufferings of those who are wounded and killed on both sides in that conflict. And it's very impartial, I think. Homer treats war as something that's just part of human activity. It's something awful, but it exists. It's something people do. It's something people want to do, as painful and awful as it is. And obviously they get some satisfaction out of it too. It's a very masculine activity and connected with notions of glory and assertion. And I think that throughout most of history, all of history actually, that's been the attitude to war. It isn't saying that people like war, but it is saying that they think war is inevitable. Goya is a kind of turning point. I think what's interesting about Goya, what's magnificent and admirable about Goya, is that these are images of protest. They're not just showing us what is horrible. They are saying this shouldn't happen. I don't think Homer is saying this shouldn't happen. I don't think Shakespeare is saying this shouldn't happen in Henry V, for instance, which is
quite the opposite almost.
Right, quite the opposite. I mean, although Shakespeare too can see the pity of war and the pity of suffering. I mean, no one had a greater range of emotions than Shakespeare. But he's certainly not – there's no protest in Shakespeare. I don't think there's any protest really to speak of in the representation of these conflicts until the beginning of the 19th century and until Goya. I think Goya is a kind of turning point. Goya is actually saying we should be horrified. We should not just find this horrible. We should be horrified. We should protest. We should deplore. We should take a moral position.
And which of his paintings do you find the most moving in its or –
Well,
what he
shows in this series of images is tremendous sadistic cruelties of soldiers against civilians, One of the most shocking statistics I know of is that in the First World War, 90% of the casualties were – I may be off by a few points, but more or less 90% of the casualties were military – were soldiers. And in the Second World War, something like 90% of the casualties were civilians. And that's the direction we're going. And that, of course, is why the Peninsular Wars are kind of forerunner of modern war, where you have soldiers making war against civilians. They couldn't bomb them yet, but they were on their way. And Goya is reacting to a new kind of war, a new kind of war on European soil at any rate. And what he shows are the most awful things. I mean, people being dismembered, hanging, people who are hanged, who have had their limbs amputated. What's so striking in these Goya images are the captions, which apparently are by Goya himself, where he says things like, "Can you believe it? Can you look at this? This is impossible to look at."
Which is a sort of modernist kind of
very, yes, caption. Not identifying and saying, you know, this happened in such and such a place. Or sometimes he'll say, "I saw it." Or, "I saw this too," or, "This is the truth," one of them says, his captions. They're utterly modern, unique captions. They're a cry of horror and indignation. There's nothing like it in the history of art.
Susan Sontag, from a conversation in 2003, we spoke just before the American invasion of Iraq and a year before she died. In a minute, we'll look at how the Vietnam War was fought and refought in the movies.
Fighting soldiers from the sky.
I know one Vietnam vet who told me that when they showed the Green Berets at the end, when John Wayne is walking off into the misplaced sunset with the Vietnamese boy, troops threw beer cans at the screen.
The brave men of the Green Berets.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
These are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only three win the Green Beret.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. This month, it'll be 5 years since the beginning of the Iraq War. To mark that anniversary, we're revisiting a conversation I had in early 2003, just before the war started, with the late writer Susan Sontag. She and I talked about her experiences in war zones and about the artistic depictions and cultural impact of war in general. At one point, I asked her about Jeff Wall, a Canadian art photographer whom she'd written about.
Well, Jeff Wall is one of a group of photographers who essentially photograph tableaus. They photograph situations which are set up and if you want to say staged. They also do a lot through digital manipulation. So they're the actual photograph, in fact, may be a composite of a number of photographs that are melded together digitally. And I was was thinking about. Well, we have all these horrible photographs and all these upsetting photographs, and part of our life is looking at these images of terrible things that are happening to other people, not us, by definition, a situation of safety. If you're watching it as an image, you're not there. And I was trying to think if there could be images that could preserve their quality of protest, that wouldn't sort of dry up or evaporate, and what images would continue to appall us or stir us or move us or make us reflect. I think it's clearly true, for me at any rate, that images which are part of a narration can continue to have that effect. I can think of certain war films that I've seen over and over again, and I never get used to them. I never stop being moved by them and stirred by them and provoked to reflection.
Jeff Wall's work that I've seen reproduced is this, as you say, this whatever the opposite of a tableau vivant is, a tableau mort,
I guess. Yeah, well, it is a kind of tableau vivant, but that's just the point. You see, I was trying to think, well, I know that we can do this with movies, but the question was, could a still image have that? And I thought, well, an image that continues to haunt me is Jeff Wall's reconstruction in his studio in Vancouver. He's a Canadian, of an imagined event in the war in Afghanistan that was waged futilely and with enormous loss of life on both sides by Russia in the late 1980s. And his picture is called Dead Troops Talk. And it shows 13 dead Russian soldiers. Most of them are sitting upright and talking on a slope.
But also horribly wounded and
horribly
obviously dead.
Horribly wounded, many of them missing limbs or tops of their skulls or whatever. And they're smiling and talking to each other. It's an extraordinary at first when I saw it, I assumed, because it actually has a place and a date in the full title of the picture. I think the picture was made in, if I recall correctly, 1992, but it's dated as something that happened, I believe, in 1986. It turns out it doesn't refer to a particular ambush by Afghan soldiers, Taliban, I guess they would have to be called.
Pre-Taliban, I think.
Well, proto-Taliban, let's put it, very much supported by the United States at that time. There isn't a very specific ambush, but certainly things like that happened all the time. And the candor of the image, the starkness of it, the kind of contradiction between the expressions that they have and the way and what's actually happened to them, maybe that's part of the secret of an image which continues to move us. Jeff Wall, with his image of war, was giving us something horrible, but not allowing us to immediately go to the obvious or cliche response to it. And so the image guards its power. It keeps its power. And that is really the question. How do images keep their power? Goya, still for me, every time I see the disasters of war in a museum, I mean, you can see it in many museums in the world. Many museums have copies of this print series. I never stop being horrified by it. Sometimes I have to walk out of the room.
The late Susan Sontag. We spoke in 2003, just before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. You can see that photograph by Jeff Wall that we were talking about at our website, studio360.org. The closest that most of us civilians ever get to a war zone is in a movie theater. So what happens to our understanding of a war after we watch it reenacted a dozen times in a dozen different films? The U.S. pulled out of Vietnam in 1975, and we've been watching movies about it ever since for my entire adult life. We asked two war movie experts to help us sort through them. Larry Suet is a naval historian and the author of Guts and Glory. Frank McAdams wrote The American War Film. He fought as a Marine in Vietnam and, when he came home, studied screenwriting at UCLA.
When I was at UCLA in grad school, I was what they called a closet vet. All I wanted to do, I was back there on the GI Bill, and all I wanted to do was to get there, learn as much as I can while I was there, get my master's degree, and get out. But I made the mistake one cold day of wearing my Marine Corps field jacket, and all of a sudden I found out that I had compromised myself. People were asking me what I did in Vietnam and everything, did I serve over there, and then they would always go to the proverbial question, how many people did you kill over there? And I would just look at him and I would imitate John Wayne. Well, Pilgrim, I wanted to go back again to put some more babies on the end of my bayonet. And they would look at me and they would realize that I was mocking them. That was the only way that I could really handle that.
Out here, due process is a bullet.
John Wayne's The Green Berets, released by Bat Jack in 1968, has the dubious distinction of being the only Vietnam War film released while the war was still going on.
Most people in Hollywood opposed the war, but they would not put their money where their mouth was. They were afraid films about Vietnam wouldn't sell, even if they were anti-Vietnam. Whatever you think of John Wayne, you must give credit to the fact that he put his money where his mouth was and told the story about the war, which he supported.
And by the time the film was released in 1968, it didn't have the type of reception that John Wayne and a lot of other people that had a World War II mentality. It didn't have the reception that they thought. I know one Vietnam vet who told me that at his compound in Vietnam, when they showed the Green Berets at the end, when John Wayne is walking off into the misplaced sunset with the Vietnamese boy, troops threw beer cans at the screen.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung.
Some people saw the movie Patton,
released in 1970,
as a non-Vietnam Vietnam movie and showing what was wrong with the American military in the shape of Patton.
Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war.
When that film was shown on the USC campus, there was a great deal of concern because on one side of the audience in Bovard Auditorium was the West Point Glee Club, which was in town for a television appearance. On the other side of the audience was a tremendously radical anti-war group.
An army is a team. This individuality stuff is a bunch of crap.
And as he's saying this, people in the audience are starting to guffaw because you're hearing it from the biggest individual of them all.
We're going to cut out their living guts and use them to grease the treads of our tanks. We're going to murder those lousy Hun bastards by the bushel.
After the end of the film, when the whole audience saw that this wasn't just a war film, that this was a story about a very deep, troubled, complex, ego-driven man, everybody filed out quietly.
On the other hand, Nixon watched the movie twice in the White House before he decided to invade Cambodia.
Right after Patton came out, there was kind of a dearth, so to speak. The Vietnam War film door was still locked to Hollywood.
The real movement started with Apocalypse Now in May of 1975 when Francis Ford Coppola came into the Pentagon with a script. Coppola took 4 years to make the movie, and in the meantime, you had a whole series of movies about Vietnam, starting with Boys and Company C.
Go Tell the Spartans.
The Deer Hunter.
The Deer Hunter, which was 1978, and Apocalypse Now, 1979.
Most of these stories show the worst things real and imagined, with an emphasis on imagined.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Apocalypse Now was based on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness.
Are you an assassin?
It was a very surreal film, but it nonetheless was a journey upriver into darkness.
There is some beautiful things in it, some beautiful filmmaking. The problem is at least some of those scenes are taken directly from other movies, and, you know, the rest of it is Coppola's meditations on war and life, but he'd never been in war. So it ultimately doesn't ring true.
It wasn't until Platoon in 1986.
That's what this place feels like, hell.
That was much more realistic, obviously. It was done by Oliver Stone, who came back with a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. There was a time when I couldn't see Platoon a second time. That final firefight in Platoon really did something to me. I sat there in the theater, and I felt I was perspiring. And I remember my wife Patty and I walked out in silence, and we went to a nearby pizza joint. And I think I unloaded on her and talked nonstop for 2 hours, all about Vietnam. And I never thought that a movie would ever move me like that. But that final firefight did.
The United States thinks we're a peace-loving people. The reality is the United States was created out of war.
Americans traditionally love to fight.
The American Revolution. The War of 1812. The War against Mexico. The Civil War. Spanish-American War. World War I, World War II, and even Korea.
The American war film genre reflects American history.
And I've always argued that war movies are popular because the American people, whether they will admit it or not, love violence.
All real Americans love the sting of battle.
Somebody once wrote, "Hell is the impossibility of reason." That's what this place feels like, hell.
The horror.
Larry Seward is the author of Guts and Glory. We also heard from Frank McAdams, who is the author of the American War film. Jonathan Mitchell produced our segment. I'm Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360. In 2003, the late Susan Sontag joined me on the program just before the beginning of the Iraq War. I asked her about the fact that most Americans know war only through the movies and what the consequences of that are.
Well, Kurt, I think that for most people under 40 or over 40, since blessedly this country, maybe in some respect to its detriment, has known much less of war than most other countries, most people know about any war is through, let's say, movies or television programs. What do they know about World War II, for instance? That's just a bunch of movies also. I don't think people learn very much from these movies because I think what is much deeper in this country is glorification of war. What we're seeing right now is the views, let's say, of Theodore Roosevelt, who is really the first very articulate spokesperson of the American imperialist dream, who thought that war was the noblest sport.
Although it seems to me that war movies about World War II, about Vietnam, whatever, in the last 25 years have portrayed a more complex, far less glorifying picture.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I think, again, as the Spanish Civil War was the point at which we have the first really close in the middle of it kind of imagery of war with the camera. So Vietnam is a turning point. That's the first moment in which photographers and people who reported on war for mainstream media actually came to feel that they were criticizing the war and that by showing the horror of war, they were protesting against war. People forget that, for instance, in World War II, Robert Capa, along with every other accredited photographer, wore combat uniforms. They were actually completely integrated into the military. There was no sense of an independent press which was assessing what the military would do. But World War II was that unique war, a war that was genuinely felt by people to have been necessary. If ever a war was necessary, it was World War II.
The writer Susan Sontag, speaking with me in 2003, the year before she died. When the Congolese Civil War broke out in 1997, the novelist Emmanuel Dungala was teaching at the University of Brazzaville. He and his family fled to the edge of the city thinking they'd be safe. Dungala remembers the terror of hiding in a house with 40 other people. They listen to rockets hiss by them and explode a few yards away.
During this bombing, while people were praying or crying or whatever, I'm not a very religious person, so what I was doing is reading. You know, you had 6 hours of bombing, you have nothing to do, just sit there. So to keep your sanity, you have to do something. I remember one poem by Robert Lowell, just the last stanza stick to my mind, and it keeps coming up. And I remember the poem is called Waking Early Sunday Morning. Pity the planet, all joy gone from this sweet volcanic cone. Peace to our children when they fall in small war on the hills of small war, until the end of time to police the earth, a ghost orbiting forever lost in our monotonous sublime. So that's it. So it keeps coming up to my mind, you know, pity the planet, all joy gone. After this war, I was very lucky to know a writer, African writer, called Chinua Achebe. And after the Biafra War, because he went through a civil war too, and he wrote a collection of poems called Christmas in Biafra and other poems. And one of the poems which really struck me, it's called A Refugee Mother and Child. No Madonna and child could touch that picture of a mother's tenderness for a son she soon would have to forget. The air was heavy with odors of diarrhea of unwashed children, with washed-out ribs and dried-up bottoms struggling in labored steps behind blown, empty bellies. Most mothers there had long ceased to care, but not this one. She held a ghost smile between her teeth, and in her eyes the ghost of a mother's pride as she combed the rust-colored hair left on his skull, and then, singing in her eyes, began carefully to part it. In another life, this must have been a little daily act of no consequence before his breakfast and school. Now she did it like putting flowers on a tiny grave. Exactly. So these women, and you know the kid is going to die, but yet you see this mother there trying to save her kid. I mean, this poem brings all that back to my mind. I came to this sad conclusion that any crime you can imagine, any worst thing you can imagine, a human being can do it to another human being. Mbula nembale yolo babwe, yolo babwe, yolo babwe. Mbula nembale yolo babwe mama, yolo babwe mama, yolo babwe. Emmanuel Dongala is a novelist from the Congo. He now teaches at Bard College at Simon's Rock in Western Massachusetts.
That's so moving to me. The poem of Robert Lowell, the idea that he was sitting and reading this
in the middle of the Civil War in the Congo.
Absolutely extraordinary. But he does say something. Well, this is obviously a marvelous guy. I've never heard of him, but I'm very glad
he's
to
a lovely writer.
Make his acquaintance, and I'll look for his books. He does say something that to me is very, very important. He says that everything that you can imagine that's most horrible, you can be sure that human beings, some human beings, have done this or will do this to other human beings. And I really feel that is the basis of being, that knowledge, that acknowledgement is the basis of being morally adult. What drives me crazy is people perpetually expressing surprise that terrible things happen in the world. I mean, it doesn't mean we're not going to be horrified. It doesn't mean we're not going to be appalled. It doesn't mean we're not going to protest and do whatever we can to limit or undo these horrors. But we shouldn't be surprised. How can it be that the commandant at Auschwitz would come home after a day of, you know, ripping babies from their mother's arms and bashing their heads against the wall and sending people off to the crematoria, and then he would come back to his house and kiss his wife and children and sit down at the piano and play some Schubert before dinner? How is this possible? I think it's absurd to ask such a question. Of course it's possible. Who said that wicked people don't have family lives or have good taste in music? Monsters don't come with signs over their heads saying, I'm a monster, and then they don't participate in any other human activities. I think we have to understand that it's human beings who do this, and we have to stop being surprised.
It interested me listening to that poem about a particular African child dying in its mother's arms, because one sees images, and you see a million images of a million dying African children, and yet to have a story attached to a particular child, to me anyway, makes it much more powerful than any number of those images can be, which I think goes to your point about a story is much more powerful than an image in and of itself.
A narration, yes. But the other thing that it brings to mind is that in our part of the world, when we see these images, the implicit sort of subtext of those images is this is the kind of thing that happens in a place like that. We're much more protective of ourselves and of people with whom we identify, which is to say, for instance, Europeans and North Americans, and what we show of the horrors that befall people. You remember there was a lot of discussion about what was right or what was in good taste to show among the photographs that were taken after September 11th, 2001, here in New York at the World Trade Center. And there certainly were photographs that showed body parts and the horror of all those thousands of people who were murdered there. And the general feeling is, oh, we mustn't show those pictures. It's in bad taste, I mean, which is always a very dubious criterion, especially when offered by institutions. It always sounds very repressive to me when people talk about good taste when it's a newspaper or a television network. And then the whole issue of giving offense to relatives or further pain to relatives, we mustn't do that. But we don't have a problem about showing these images if they come from Africa or Asia because we don't identify with those people. For instance, there's that appalling image which upset me enormously, which I think about all the time, of a Taliban soldier being murdered. He's naked from the waist down. His bloody pants around his ankles. It's the most horrifying image. And I think when we look at it in the New York Times, and it's Tyler Hicks is a wonderful war photographer, I think we don't think, well, his relatives, say, in Kabul might have seen this image too. And what did they feel? So it's very much a double standard about the horror that we show.
The late Susan Sontag speaking with me in 2003. Coming up, we'll talk about staging theater in a Sarajevo war zone. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. On the fifth anniversary of the Iraq invasion, we're revisiting a show we recorded in 2003 with Susan Sontag. We were talking about artists responding to war. Another writer we heard from was Alexander Hamon, who's Bosnian. Now, imagine traveling abroad for a few weeks. You turn on the TV one day and see your hometown in flames and under siege.
The voting ended, and within hours, the shooting began.
That's what happened in 1992 to Hamon, the author of the novel Nowhere Man. He was in Chicago when the Bosnian War broke out.
The Bosnian government has urged these Serbs to abandon their positions by nightfall. So far from doing that, they are reinforcing them and bringing in heavier weapons.
He found out as much as he could from the TV news and by trying to phone Sarajevo, and he read letters from home, including one from a fellow journalist.
A man who's a friend of mine, Semezdin Mehmedinovic, who is probably the greatest living Bosnian poet, who lives in Washington, D.C. now, where the air is tinted with evil. He was in Sarajevo during the siege and left shortly after the war ended. And he wrote a great book called Sarajevo Blues. They're very short little vignettes. This is one called A Relatively Calm Day. In the daily reports, when dozens of shells hit downtown proper, when snipers are in action at the intersections and only a few have been killed or wounded, we are informed that a relatively calm day has passed. People are relatively normal or relatively loony since death has been accepted as a statistic. That is to say, in Sarajevo, the issue is a surplus of death. A flustered young man begs to cut into the waterline. He shows his plastic canister. The line in front of the cistern twists to make a place for him. Since he's already loaded his canister, he hurries to the end of the street and gets hit by a grenade. All that's left of him is a bloody trail on the pavement that seems like sap, but is easier to clean. Just then it starts raining and everything gets washed away. Not even a trace of the young guy is left, nor a trace of the canister, just water. As if nothing in the street changed, except that everyone got just a bit quieter. The motor of the water truck rumbles to the sound of plastic canisters softly bumping against each other. The experience of war is too big to be captured by one person. I had known his work before that. You know, he was a good friend of mine. And with good friends, you always think that in some ways they are like you. So the way that he experienced the war allowed me to imagine how I would experience that war, on the one hand. On the other hand, because he's so articulate and so thoughtful, I could see how he never mind me, how he experienced the war. I mean, in some ways you can read literature for warnings, but literature is always in some ways about someone else's experience. And when it becomes your experience, then it's a little too late.
The Bosnian writer Alex Hamon now lives in America. Studio 360's Michelle Siegel produced that piece, as well as the segment with Emmanuel Dungala. Susan, you went to Sarajevo for off and on for several years during the siege. You describe it as quixotic. But why did you go? Why did you put yourself in that place?
Well, I think... I should act on what I believe, and I think, how can I put it? It's an extraordinary experience. It's a deepening experience. It's actually a privilege, I think, to be able to do something. Otherwise, I guess I just would go crazy thinking about what's happening. I think I wouldn't want to think about it after a certain point if I didn't know that once in a while, every few years, I would just step out of my own life and try to get involved with something larger where I could make a tiny, 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 tiny contribution. And that's all, of course, one can do.
One of the things you did there was to stage Samuel Beckett's play, Waiting for Godot. How did that work, and why did you do that?
Well, I have directed in the theater, and I had no idea of doing that while I was there. But while I was there, when I at the end of my first stay, which was a couple of weeks, and I told people that I wanted to come back, and they asked me what for, and I said, well, I want to work, and well, what can you do? And I said, well, I can do some paramedic things. And I can type and I can teach. And anyway, I was trying to think of things that would be useful. And then I said, well, and I know how to direct in the theater. And I said, oh, do that. And I was actually quite disappointed. I wanted to work in a hospital because when I was young, I wanted to be a physician. It's like frustrated vocation. And I said, why do you want me to direct a play? Oh, well, because we have lots of actors who have nothing to do. I said, actors? You don't have theaters. You just have bombed places. Yes, but it you know what people said to me? It was so moving. They said, well, we're not animals, you know. We're not people just standing on water lines and bread lines and cowering in basements during the shelling and the sniping. I mean, there was theater in Sarajevo before the war. There should be theater now. And I was very moved by that. But actually, it was not something I thought I wanted to do. I had the usual reaction that everybody has. Oh, what do you need that for? I'd rather that somebody learned, you know, taught me how to bake bread.
So they dragged you back into the arts, right?
Well, they asked me to do it. And then, of course, the question, well, what would you do? And, you know, the choice of the Beckett play seemed rather obvious because we were all, as everyone would say, waiting for Clinton. We were waiting for one or two little bombs on the Serbs, you know, to make them stop. And that was the joke, that Waiting for Godot was really waiting for Clinton. And it was a fantastic experience. And people came. We performed every day for about 6 months after rehearsing a couple of months. I had to put everybody, the audience included, on the stage because if you put people actually in the seats in a theater, there was the only theater that was even functioning at all in the sense that it was partly intact, had a huge chandelier. So we were always afraid of a direct hit. So the audience, which could be as much as 150 people or so on bleachers, sat on the stage. We had no electricity, of course. No one had electricity, and the stage was lit by candles. And we would perform at 10 in the morning, 12 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon. And people came. People came through the shelling and the bombing. It was risking their lives to come to the theater. It was the most extraordinary experience.
Never were you more eloquent as a moralist as in your writing a few years ago about Bosnia and the Balkans. I look back as before this program to read a piece you wrote in the New York Times Magazine that was an absolutely spot on, it seemed to me, critique of sort of European inaction and kind of a kind of taken for granted European anti-Americanism. And as part of your argument for the need for us to intervene militarily, does it strike you not as a contradiction at all, your your feelings about that war and your critique of Europe and their sort of dithering state over that war, and what I presume are your feelings about this war we're about to be involved in, but perhaps I'm presuming too far.
Well, I think, unfortunately, we are going to wage this war. We didn't move 100 – our government didn't move 100,000 troops and all that material to Iraq to back off. This is a tough question, but and one I think about a lot. Someone like Noam Chomsky would say, who is a cross-the-board critic of American imperialism, would say you cannot –
and of America.
Well, let's say of the imperialist venture in America, yes, and of, implicitly of America, would say you can't pick and choose. You can't be a liberal imperialist and say here we should intervene, there we shouldn't. I'm afraid I am a liberal imperialist. I'm not against the proper use of American power. I'm absolutely for the intervention in Bosnia. I wish it had happened a lot earlier, and I wish it had amounted to something. I'm for and continue to be for the intervention in Kosovo, even though I deplore the way it was pursued, which incurred a lot of unnecessary civilian deaths from American bombing. I wish that the Americans had intervened in Rwanda, which I think is the most single horrible thing that's happened anywhere in past decades. I am against the punitive preemptive war in Iraq because I think it's folly. I think it won't accomplish what it's designed to accomplish. I think it will. I think it's the wrong way to deal with this monstrous dictator whose overthrow I ardently look forward to.
But why was it right in the Slobodan Milosevic's case and not here?
Because it was bound to do what it could do at a very minimal cost of life. And this is opening a can of worms, a Pandora's box that will destabilize the whole region, that involves an imperial ambition that I don't think we're prepared to carry through. We may be prepared to kill a lot of people, civilians in Baghdad. I'm not sure we're prepared to rule the Middle East yet.
Although we don't want to kill civilians in Baghdad.
No, but if we decide to pursue a war in which the presumption is we will take ideally no casualties, then we will have to bomb and bomb very heavily and bomb from on high when it's very difficult to distinguish civilian from military targets. That's just a matter of fact. I don't think this is the way to deal with Saddam Hussein. And I think that the consequences – I think it's folly. I think it's mad. I think it's dangerous.
So you don't think there's a high possibility or any possibility that you will be proven wrong by how the war goes?
I pray to be proven wrong, but I don't believe it. I think it's much more dangerous and much more reckless. But I think that the motives are deplorable to extend American hegemony and to institute a new doctrine of preemptive war whenever the United States considers itself endangered, which to me is absolutely a wicked policy. I mean, no one thought that the reason to intervene in Bosnia, Kosovo, or Rwanda was because the United States was in danger. The reason was because horrible things were going on which the Americans could prevent or terminate.
In this time of war and rumors of war and imminent war perhaps, are there works of art that we should go to for explanation, illumination, solace?
Well, I talked before about art as a platform for moral consciousness. I guess I could expand on that a little and say that what finally matters to me about the arts, whether it's literature or film or other dramatic arts or music or dance, is the way it deepens us, the way it extends our feelings. I think of the arts as renewing that possibility of extending feeling and tenderness and compassion and the ability just to recognize everyone's humanity, because in the end the most important thing is that we are all human beings, including the people that commit these wicked acts.
Susan Sontag, thank you very much for joining me today in Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. It's been great. Thanks.
Susan Sontag speaking with me on the eve of the Iraq War in 2003. She died age 71 a year later.
A book of her speeches and essays called At the Same Time was published in 2007. There's a transcript of this whole show and more about Sontag and her extraordinary career at studio360.org. That is it for today's program. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Lital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Katie Rolnick,
Andrea Salenzi,
and Nat Wiener.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who support CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
You know, I was a soldier, and if I did wrong, here I am.
Any regrets?
No, ma'am.
Before Abu Ghraib, just before the war began, I talked to the late writer Susan Sontag.
How is this possible? I think it's absurd to ask such a question. Of course it's possible. It's human beings who do this, and we have to stop being surprised.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to PRI's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org.